Good evening. This is Life Rattle, your story show. I'm your host, Tracy Moniz. Tonight, on Life Rattle number 1316, I'm the guest host for a special East Coast program featuring two new Life Rattle writers, Jamie Gillingham and Robin Young. Our first reader tonight, Jamie Gillingham, was born in 1990 and grew up in what he affectionately calls the bowels of Newfoundland, Clark's Head, Gander Bay. In 2006, at 16 years old, Jamie left home to live with relatives and attend a high school that proved slightly more forgiving towards just about everything, but especially the things that interested him: writing, music, and boys. After high school, it took Jamie 3 years of studying behavioral neuroscience to realize he couldn't care less about behavioral neuroscience. And so for the next 3 years, Jamie split his time between the north end of Halifax and Toronto's Kensington Market. He completed a public relations degree and even saw Ryan Gosling in the flesh. Jamie Gillingham is certain that one day he'll learn to love Newfoundland and perhaps even return for good. But for now, he's a whole ocean away, completing his master's in creative writing in Wales. Jamie Gillingham writes with an honest and direct voice. His finely crafted stories capture the complexity of human relationships and the vulnerability of life's raw moments. With detailed prose and a natural flow, Jamie's writing connects with readers and draws us in. In tonight's first story, a young man boards a bus in St. John's, Newfoundland, and makes the 4-hour trek to his hometown in Gander Bay. There, he plans to finally make an important revelation to his parents. Let's listen now as Jamie Gillingham reads his story, Making My Mother Cry, on Life Rattle.
I'm in grade 8, when I first truly see Mavis as more than just a mom, more than just a parent whose main job is to remain unwaveringly constant, hinged, and present. It's a Wednesday morning, and I'm standing over the stovetop, monitoring my fried egg, worried I might miss that crucial moment for the over-easy. I grab the metal spatula instead of the plastic one, because I like its sturdiness. Mavis looks at me from the kitchen table and furrows her brow. "Don't use that spatula," she tells me. "You'll scratch the pan." Mavis thinks little of her comment and returns to her breakfast, a hard-boiled egg and 2 slices of buttered toast. "Fuck, Mom." I yell a profanity at her for the first time. I guess I can't do anything right, can I? I stare at Mavis, breathing heavily, and refuse to break eye contact. Her tears gather slowly, but the longer I hold my glare, the faster they seem to pool. It dawns on me that Mavis isn't impenetrable, as I had first thought, that she doesn't exist for the sole purpose of making me content. She has feelings, and like all people, having "fuck" yelled at her hurts. Several minutes later, at some point between my cursing and her tears, I realize Mavis had retreated to her bedroom. I say sorry 3 times until she finally accepts my apology, all from outside her locked door. "Is that what you really think?" she says in a muffled voice between sobs. "Well, no," I reply. "I think I've just had a bad week." 8 years later, I'm 21 years old, and in my second term of university, when I make Mavis cry for the second time. I board a bus at 7 in the morning in St. John's on the first day of Thanksgiving break. It's a 4-hour trek to my parents' house, a trip I have made countless times before but don't enjoy. Each morning, I spend the cab ride to the bus stop thinking of ways to deter people from sitting in the seat beside me. Look unapproachable, or maybe uninterested. Better yet, look ill, terminal even. But I still seem to attract the biggest busgoers, in personality, and more notably, in stature. Nearly all have an unwavering affinity for chit-chat, with little to no respect for the suggestion of my headphones. The day before Thanksgiving break, I had spent the evening talking with my roommate. We devised a plan to finally tell my parents that I'm gay, even though I'm not entirely sure myself what that means. I decide that I'll do it in the early stages of my visit. I want to give them time to digest the news, time for them to mull it over before I faced what would undoubtedly be a multitude of questions for which I had no answers. I assure myself that if I tell them on Friday, things will be back to normal by Sunday. Mavis will go back to asking me about the state of my finances, and my dad and I will continue to watch Sunday football, the only difference being he'll figure out my motive. It turns out that a son, specifically me, telling his parents, specifically my parents, that he prefers the company of men, specifically quick-witted, handsome men, is far more daunting than I had first thought. On Friday evening, Mavis and I discuss the intricacies of her latest mystery novel, and I drop hints about my sexual orientation where I can. But what if Detective Murray has a secret of his own? Something he's incredibly afraid to tell people. "You're right," she says. "I bet he's Catholic." Come Sunday, I still haven't told my parents. Moments before leaving to catch the bus back to school, I convince myself that this is my only chance. If I don't tell them now, they may never find out, at least from me. I decide to write a letter instead, and leave it on the counter, in the open, where Mavis will surely find it after she returns from dropping me off at the bus stop. People often say that time moves slowly when waiting for something you expect to happen. I would agree, and would further propose a hierarchy of slowly moving time. For instance, time moves relatively slow when waiting for Christmas morning. It moves even slower when waiting for high school to end, and considerably slower still for university. I can now confirm that time moves slowest when waiting for your mother to find and respond to a letter explaining that you're more will than grace. 4 hours after I leave my parents' house, I arrive at my apartment, and 30 minutes later, biding my time by stacking the groceries Mavis had given me, the phone finally rings. "I just have one question, Jamie." Mavis speaks between sobs, the same way she did 8 years ago. "Does this mean you want to wear women's clothes?"
That was Making My Mother Cry, written and read by Jamie Gillingham. Jamie's second story tonight takes us to a quaint historic inn in downtown Halifax, where our narrator meets with his new romantic interest, an eclectic, old-worldly young man. There, we experience the awkwardness and uncertainty that accompanies a new relationship. Let's listen now as Jamie Gillingham reads his story, The Waverly Inn.
If I hadn't been looking for it, I never would have noticed the Waverly Inn. The building blends seamlessly with other Victorians that line the surrounding block on Halifax's Barrington Street. And while beautiful, the sign that bears the inn's name remains somewhat hidden, tucked into a recess above the grand entrance. As I stand in front of the Waverley, a couple stroll past me, debating which restaurant will prove the least brunchy. Across the street, a cook from Talay Thai sticks his head out the door, spits, glances my way, and then heads back inside. I reach for my cell phone and reread Brendan's text. "Just call my room when you get to the lobby, the Fraser room." I pace for another moment and head inside. Brendan and I met through OkCupid. We exchanged a handful of messages online, and he soon added me as a friend to his Facebook profile. We talked about the things 20-somethings who meet on OkCupid talk about. Whether we're students, how we spend our free time, where we're from, each probing for the flaw that led the other to try online dating in the first place. We had our first date a week later over coffee. 3 days after that, he cooked dinner for me. And somewhere in between, we split a bottle of cheap red wine. The lobby of the Waverley Inn is filled with chairs that look more like thrones, and portraits of balding men hang on the walls. In the sitting room at my right, the sun streams through open curtains and bounces off glass-paned tabletops. I look for a sign that says, "This way to the Fraser room," but there isn't one, and the front desk is empty, so I climb a grand-looking staircase. "I'm here," I say to Brendan over the phone. "I can't seem to find the room." Brendan was born in Corpus Christi, Texas, where he lived until he moved to Halifax in grade 8, after his mom accepted a new job. He's equal parts Indonesian and Texan white. Except he doesn't own a gun, he's a liberal, and he doesn't at all remind me of a Bush. Brendan has jet black hair and stands about 5'9", an inch or so taller than me. He has a penchant for big words, plaid suits, and music reminiscent of Cole Porter. On Fridays, Brendan serves wine at an Orthodox Anglican church. Not because he's religious, but because he likes the ritual. My roommate thinks he's weird as fuck, but that's precisely why I like him. "Just follow the main staircase. Turn right at the top," Brendan replies. "You'll see a couple more stairs. Take those. It's a second room on your left, the Fraser room." I think how it's pretentious to name a room after a person, but the stillness of the hotel makes conversation seem against the rules. "Okay, be right there." Brendan answers the door in orange boxer briefs and a white t-shirt stained with red wine. Sunlight from the window opposite gives his disheveled black hair a fitting backlight, given the charm of the room. "Come in," he says. "Make yourself at home." I slide off my coat and toss it across an elegantly patterned armchair. At least I think it's an armchair. "This room is beautiful." "Yeah, it's lovely." Brendan reaches for a plaid sports jacket lying on the floor. "Just give me a second to gather my things, and we can make our way to the parlor for coffee." I tap my fingers against a white and gray marble desk, pretending that if the moment called for it, I would be able to comment on its quality. "Solid marble?" Brendan looks up from his pile of clothes. "What?" Embarrassed, I quickly move on. "Nothing. Yeah, okay, sounds good. I'll just..." I glance around the room, fixing on a nearby table. "Read this pamphlet on mid-18th century furniture." He smiles. I feel redeemed. 2 queen-size beds with intricate wooden headboards divide the room. Matching chests sit at the foot of each bed. At least 3 feet separate the tallest piece of furniture and the ceiling. A Victorian room heater sits in the corner underneath an open window. I might have thought Brendan was the room's first occupant, if not for scratches in the hardwood floor. All set? Brendan says, slipping into his jacket. All set. I follow Brendan down the stairs and past a room named Oscar Wilde. He stops us to chat with a housekeeper, a middle-aged black woman dressed in olive scrubs. Did Oscar Wilde really stay here? Brendan asks. I stand behind him, smiling, careful to not seem too interested in her answer. Sure did. She leans against her broom, looking content with her response. Amazing. I'll have to come back to see it sometime. We continue down the stairs to the sitting room I had seen on my way in. Brendan sits down at the table in front of the picture window, a glass chessboard and floral centerpiece flickering in the sun. I hang my jacket on a nearby rack. Join me? He says. I settle into a neatly upholstered chair across from him. A tapestry hangs on the opposite wall, and what looks like hand-carved furniture sits underneath. The front desk worker shuffles through a stack of papers in a room adjoined to the sitting room by an open door. It's weird that when a tapestry is on the floor, it's called a rug, but when it's on the wall, it's called a tapestry. I look to Brendan for a reaction. Just seems kind of two-faced, you know? Would you excuse me for 1 second? Brendan walks toward the front desk. I hear him chat and exchange laughs with the housekeeper. Her laughter is higher pitched than his and sounds slightly more awkward, the way I might laugh with an acquaintance when I wish a conversation would end. Brendan returns moments later. She shuts the door after him, grinning at me as it closes. I just hate open doors when I'm trying to have a conversation, he says. I smile. Shall we play? I think how, under normal circumstances, I would have cringed at the use of the word shall, but nothing about Brendan or this place seems normal. I also worry about my ability to play chess. I know the bare minimum, the names of the pieces and their possible moves, to get through a game. Of course, Brendan says. After you. My pawn, 2 squares forward. Brendan stares down at the board. I'm really happy that we met. He glances up with the beginning of a smile. Me too, I say. His pawn, 2 squares forward. I had been skeptical about online dating, I continue. You're a pleasant surprise. I've actually deleted my profile since, he says. I'm not sure why, but I feel flattered. My pawn, 2 squares forward. That's funny. Me too, I lie. His knight, 2 squares forward, 1 square right. This place is really amazing. I swivel to get a better view of the room. I didn't know places like this existed in Halifax. My knight, 2 squares forward, 1 square left. Yeah, I love this place, Brendan says. My friends and I come here when we feel like escaping to a different era. His rook, 7 squares forward. Right, I say. Well, it's really something. Is Shane coming back to write later? Shane is Brendan's roommate and a student of poetry at King's College. Brendan had mentioned that Shane might visit to do some writing because the place inspired him. I think so, Brendan replies, although I'm not certain. My pawn, 2 squares forward. Listen. Brendan reaches across the table for my hand. I really believe in being open and honest with the people I like. That's good. I reach for his hand. His knight, 3 squares forward, 1 square left. Check. I want you to be completely honest with me, he continues. And I want to be completely honest with you. I want that as well, I say. We sit in the parlor, drenched in sunlight. Brendan wears a 3-piece suit and holds my hand across the glass chess set. We sip coffee that I can't afford but find satisfaction in pretending otherwise. We look at one another in a way that is extremely pleasurable when it is you involved and extremely annoying when it is not. I find it difficult to imagine wanting anything else. My king, 2 squares forward, out of check. I was thinking about this when I woke up this morning. Brennan shifts in his chair, turns, and leans across the chess set, still holding my hand. I was thinking about the past week. His knight, 3 squares forward. Check. Okay, I smile. Thinking about what exactly? Brennan's expression changes, the look I had enjoyed replaced with one less comforting. I squirm. Brennan's grip loosens. My king, 1 square right. Out of check. I was thinking that a relationship isn't something I want right now. His knight, 2 squares left. Checkmate.
That was The Waverly Inn, written and read by Jamie Gillingham. Tonight's second writer, Robin Young, was born in Amherst, Nova Scotia in 1990. In the years following, he, his sister, and his mother moved to a number of towns throughout the Maritimes, looking for a place that was neither too busy nor too secluded. In 1998, the family found this in Wolfville, Nova Scotia, a vibrant university town where Robin would spend the rest of his pleasant, completely satisfactory childhood. Robin's father, all the while, remained planted at his homestead in Upper Economy, Nova Scotia, where Robin and Tessa spent weekends chasing stick boats down the nearby stream, holding 2-person sandcastles competitions, and eating unwashed carrots from the garden. Despite growing up in Atlantic Canada, Robin's parents hail from other places, his father from Montreal and his mother from London, England. It is possibly because of these outsider roots that Robin, who never felt like a true Maritimer, felt destined to explore other places. When Robin was 14, he traveled with his sister and father to France for a 2-week bike trip. Robin credits this experience with helping him to overcome his fear of uncertainty and embrace the unknown. Robin returned to France when he was 23 for a 6-month student exchange. During this time, Robin traveled by himself to 8 other countries across Europe, meeting interesting people and learning about other cultures. During these trips, Robin worked on berry farms, hang glided, wrote poetry, lay on beaches, and felt a greater sense of freedom than ever before. 1.5 years after returning from this trip, Robin has graduated from university and is making plans to move away from Halifax and find a job in public relations. In the meantime, he works at Starbucks, where he makes minimum wage and a pound of coffee a week. Robin Young writes engaging stories about everyday life, weaving in delicate detail to set a scene and nuanced dialogue to present a character. His writing has a lyrical quality to it that creates an easy and inviting flow. In Robin's first story, our young narrator reminds us what it feels like to be a child on a day at the beach. Let's listen now as Robin Young reads his story, Sandcastles.
Sandcastles by Robin Young. Tessa draws a line through the wet sand with her index finger, about 25 feet from the water's edge. She traces two large circles parallel to each other behind the line. Inside these circles, my sister and I will build sandcastles. I stand to the side and map out a plan in my head. The wind slaps at my back. Despite the blazing sun overhead, it's barely warm enough to run around shirtless. The Bay of Fundy wind can do that to a summer day. Tessa finishes drawing the two circles and starts the countdown. 3, 2, 1, go! I drop to my knees and feverishly dig into the grainy earth with my fingertips. I scrape and toss handfuls of wet, sloppy sand into a pile in the middle of my circle. Scrape and toss, scrape and toss, scrape and toss. My arms soon droop and my hands blush a deep red, but I continue. Scrape, toss, scrape, toss, scrape, toss. I break the rhythm and glance over my shoulder at Tessa. A knee-high pile of wet sand already sits in the middle of her circle, and she works on her sandcastle's outer walls. My eyes jump from Tessa to the water, only 20 or so feet away. I hurl a few more handfuls of sand onto my pile and start on the fort's barriers. I construct two walls, one near the edge of the boundary and one closer to the center, and dig a moat in between. The walls sit loose and uneven, but I don't have time to fix them. I check the tide again, 10 feet. Now, the main tower. I pack down the sides of the dirt heap in the center of the circle and shape it upwards to a high point, hopefully out of reach of the approaching waves. I level off the top and check the sides for loose dirt. I look up. The water bears down on my fortress, just inches from my castle walls. I launch out of my crouch and sprint along the water's edge. My feet smack shallow puddles that scatter the beach. I scan the dark brown of the wet sand, searching for specks of white and blue, small shells deposited by the retreating tide. I grasp a faded purple and blue mussel shell and charge back. I kneel next to my castle and rest the token on my tower's flattened summit. "Done!" shouts Tessa as the first waves cross the line and lick the outer walls of our two castles. I pant and admire my jumbled handiwork. I shift my attention to Tessa's castle. The satisfied expression on my face wilts. Her walls stand neat and square next to the messy rows of piled dirt defending my precious shell, and her tower stands taller too, with flat rocks smartly arranged to guard the vulnerable base. I scowl down at my red, stinging hands. Tessa hollers in triumph as a section of my outer wall breaks away. Seawater pours into the inner moat. The second wall holds longer, but the tide pushes forward and it topples. Within minutes, the water pushes aside my handmade defenses. Waves slap at the sides of my tower. Cracks appear. The sand shifts. The summit tips. The shell falls.
That was Sandcastles, written and read by Robin Young. Robin's second story tonight takes us back to junior high, where our narrator, a young student, befriends the new kid in school. Let's listen now as Robin Young reads his story, Sheldon.
Sheldon, by Robin Young. He sits on a grassy hill beside Wolfville Junior High's soccer field, wearing basketball shorts that reach to his knees and a dark blue Harley Davidson t-shirt. His brawny physique, unusual for a 13-year-old, gives him an intimidating look from afar. I walk over anyways. My new soccer cleats squeak with each step I take and alert him to my approach. I stop a few feet away. Are you new? He takes a moment to look me over. Yeah? I'm Robin. I stretch out my scrawny arm. He cracks a slight smile and shakes my hand. Sheldon. Silence fills the space between us for a few moments. I feel relieved when he finally breaks it. You played soccer very long? Sheldon nods towards the coach on the opposite side of the field, shuffling through a handful of papers. Yeah, but I'm not very good. I think I've only scored one goal, and that was by accident. He chuckles. Well, you'll get another soon. I'm sure of it. I feel uncomfortable standing, so I plop down beside him on the fresh grass. Where do you move here from? Liverpool, the South Shore, my grandma and I. You like it here? Sheldon shrugs. I've only been here a week, I guess. We'll see. Robin! I look towards the field and see the coach waving me over. Get over here! I've got to run. See you around, though? Sheldon smiles. Yeah, for sure. Robin! Sheldon shouts. I twist around in my chair. The legs screech against the shiny cafeteria floor. Sheldon strides towards me, past student-filled tables covered with cartons of milk, half-eaten yogurt cups, and greasy pepperoni pizzas. How's it going, man? Sheldon slaps me on the back. Hey, man. It's going well. I've got lots of homework, but whatever. I can't really complain. Yeah, I know what you mean. I don't do most of the work anyways. Sheldon laughs. It's all just shit. I don't need it. Yeah, I guess, but... I stop myself. Sheldon probably doesn't want to hear a lecture. Oh, yeah. Guess who scored a goal in our last game? I smile broadly. No way! That's wicked, man. See, I knew you'd get her. How'd it happen? There was a loose ball in the box. I just charged towards the net and popped right out for me. All I had to do was poke it in. If I had missed that one, I'd never forgive myself. Hard work and determination. That's all. Shelley! Two tall boys standing near the cafeteria entrance call out to him. One wears a black Megadeth t-shirt and black ripped jeans. The other has long, greasy hair down to his shoulders and clenches an unlit cigarette between his teeth. Shelley, get over here. We're skipping class to go downtown. Sheldon looks at me. Sorry, Robin. Gotta go. We'll talk later, though, yeah? He turns, paces towards the cafeteria entrance, and disappears from view before I can respond. My friend Tyler and I drift down the busy hall of the school to our next class. We raise our voices to hear each other over the shuffling feet, slamming lockers, and chatter of students. You still up for Saturday? I bought a new magic booster pack I want to try out. We could stay up and have some epic battles, you know? Tyler scrunches his face. Aw, yeah, I know, I reply. I just have to finish this math assignment first or Mr. Brown will kill me. He's already given me one extension. Well, you'd better not put it off too long. You've lost 6 of the last 7. You've got to salvage whatever dignity you still have left. And with these new cards, I'm going to make the most badass deck, and you're going to need all the help you can get. There will be no mercy. I shoot Tyler an over-exaggerated, frightened look, and he laughs. Tyler runs into a muscular body coming down the hall the other way, and is knocked in the ground. Not this little shit again. You're always getting in my fucking way. Sheldon's angry voice rattles through the hallway. It's strange to hear him speak with such hostility. Move off or get pummeled. I try to catch Sheldon's attention, but he continues glaring at Tyler and doesn't acknowledge me. Tyler pulls himself off the floor and stares angrily at Sheldon. A moment later, his expression softens. He snickers, his eyes still fixed on the bigger boy. Pummeled? Really? Why are you laughing, you little shit? Tyler laughs louder. Sheldon exhales angrily and grits his teeth. You're just a little runt. You know that? Your parents never wanted you. You're just a fucking runt. Tyler throws his head back and howls with mocking laughter. Sheldon begins to move towards him, fists clenched, but stops when a teacher exits her classroom and looks our way. You're just a little shit, he scowls. You're gonna get what's coming to you. Sheldon turns and walks away with heavy footsteps. I stand to the side and watch him leave. Sheldon pounds Tyler with his fists. Each blow makes a dull thudding sound that echoes off the cramped change room walls. His arms swing so quick they almost blur. Sheldon's face looks twisted and rage-stricken. It feels as though he won't ever stop. A few other students stand to the side, watching the two boys with interest. I dash across the change room and shove Sheldon just hard enough to push him off Tyler. Get off him, man! Sheldon stumbles sideways, surprised. Then, he turns and lunges at me, his fist landing squarely in my midsection. The hit drives the air from my lungs, and my face splits with pain. I lurch backwards and collapse against the white concrete wall. I gasp for air, but manage only a feeble rasp. I continue desperately gulping for air, and slowly my panicky lungs fill back up. I look up and see Sheldon staring at me, his face blank. The rage has disappeared. He looks lost. A moment later, he breaks his gaze and looks back to Tyler, still curled up against the wall. His glare returns. He spins around and stamps out of the change room. I stare at the change room door as it slides closed. Tears trickle down my warm cheeks.
That was Robin Young reading his story, Sheldon. This concludes Life Rattle number 1316. My name is Tracy Moniz. I recorded Jamie Gillingham and Robin Young reading their stories. Life Rattle was created by Arnie Actman and Guy Allen.